Cows don't have a crude protein requirement. They have an amino acid requirement. And therefore, can we get the right levels of methionine, lysine, histidine, all those to our dairy cows? And of course, that has, again, forage quality written on it, because forage quality stimulates the rumen fermentation, which means I grow those bacteria. And maybe some of our listeners are surprised to hear about two-thirds of the protein that our cow needs, she will actually grow in her rumen, and the amino acid profile of the bacteria are all perfect. Really matches up with the amino acid profile of milk protein and lean tissue there as well.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible.
Kemin invites you to optimize animal feed quality and safety with our portfolio of solutions. Learn more at kemin.com/AG. Evonik, we are sciencing the global food challenge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the Feed Science Podcast Show, brought to you by Wisenetics. I am Wilmer Pacheco. I am an associate professor in the Department of Poultry Science at Auburn University. We are dedicated to bringing you the latest insights and discussions in the feed industry. So get ready to expand your knowledge and stay ahead with today's episode. And today I have the pleasure of having as a guest Dr. Michael Hutchins. Dr. Michael is a professor emeritus in animal science at the University of Illinois, where he built an incredible career focused on dairy nutrition and extension education. And today we will be diving into a key topic for any dairy operation related to building milk components and how nutrition, management, and innovation all come together to make it happen. Dr. Michael, it is a privilege to have you on the show today. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. And it's my honor to be part of the program and to share the microphone with you here today. And I hope we have some good information for those people that are going to be listening to the podcast. Thanks for the invitation.
Thank you, Michael. I'm sure that we are going to learn a lot today. So to start, can you share your journey in dairy science and what initially sparked your interest in dairy nutrition and what led you to build your career at the University of Illinois?
Well, very good, Wilmer. I grew up on a dairy farm near Green Bay, Wisconsin, so that probably is the roots for the interest on dairy. And of course, did the 4-H and FFA things from there. I got all three of my degrees at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in dairy science. My PhD ended up being a joint degree between nutritional science and dairy science with a minor in biochemistry. So once I graduated there, I then had an opportunity to join the University of Minnesota staff over at the St. Paul campus. And I spent 8 years over there. That was 100% extension. I love extension, primarily because I had a chance to see some very good extension workers at Wisconsin and said, wow, that's kind of a neat job as far as that goes. So I spent 8 years over there and as an extension specialist, and also had a part-time teaching appointment because we had an untimely passing of a faculty member. And therefore, I took over the dairy evaluation classes and coached the team. And we were very lucky in 1978 to win the national contest in Madison, Wisconsin. Then after that, Illinois had an opportunity to lead their dairy extension program. At that time, there was four of us in that group there. And so I went to Illinois. It was an opportunity that looked good to me. And it was also a dairy science department, which made it kind of a unique opportunity as well compared to, say, Minnesota, which was an animal science department. And so I spent basically 32 years there. Much like what happened at Illinois, I ended up getting a partial teaching appointment. In fact, it ended up being a 50% teaching appointment. I taught all of the introductory classes on dairy science and nutrition. That was three different classes that would be taught as far as that goes. That worked out really well, and I really enjoyed that equally as well. At the same time, I also developed the first online credit certificate program. And so people could enroll. We had six universities that were participating in this class, and students both at the University of Illinois and places like at Iowa State and Michigan State, the students could also earn a certificate if they took courses here and at their host school as well. I really enjoyed that. I think that's where the future of extension is going to be going, is going to be just what you're doing today, podcasting, online teaching, webinars, you know, because people just cannot always come to a meeting place at a certain time and a certain day as far as that goes. So then I retired in 2010 and then had a chance to continue teaching part-time here at the University of Illinois. And then I had an opportunity to go to with the Santa Fe Institute in Brazil and redevelop this online teaching class. And right now we are teaching over 2,000 different students enrolled in that class, 5 different languages it's translated to. And I think they're using AI to make that translation, but it's Portuguese, Spanish, Arabic, English, of course, in Islam as well. And I find that very exciting as well. So that's kind of how we did. I think the roots go all the way back to my Wisconsin growing up on a dairy farm and said, gee, and the training at Wisconsin was tremendous.
Well, that's a really impressive career. I can tell that you have been in a very beautiful places. I have been in the campus in Madison, and it's a beautiful campus. And thank you for doing all what you do. And, you know, like in this podcast, I would like to discuss some meal components. And my first question for you is why meal components are important in today's market?
Well, Wilmer, that's a great question. And it's important because over 80% of the milk here in the United States is priced on how many pounds of protein, how many pounds of fat, and how many pounds of other solids leave the farm every day. And so so milk volume is important, but so is the percent components in that milk leaving the farm. To give our listeners a good idea right now, the value of milk right now, components, a pound of milk fat is worth $2.64 a pound, milk protein $2.17 a pound, and other solids, 31 cents a pound. So certainly you can see fat and protein really drive that. And of course, Wilmer, the number we like to use is if you're producing 7 pounds of fat and protein from your farm, from each cow each day, you really are doing extremely well out there in the program. So it's a combination of both milk volume and milk components that contribute to that milk check. So we say if you're going to build a milk check, you're going to build pounds of components that's going to leave there. And the other important thing, that not only are components important, but we export. And right now, the good news is that we export about 18% of the milk in the United States. Of course, the whole dilemma we're facing now with tariffs, and it's going to be a factor. We'll enter into that. But right now, the good news is we are the cheapest producer of cheese in the world. Right now, the world, we're at 172 is what they, and this is some April prices. The European Union was 242. New Zealand was 223. And the same pattern in butter. So we're the lowest producers in terms of exporting of other countries that want to buy it, where we would fit in.
And you know, like how does nutrition and let's say, you know, how does forage quality and fiber levels impact those components?
Well, certainly we know that some of the real keys that we're going to have to drive those components, we're going to look at both sides of the equation. The first side find is milk yield, and that's just peak milk. That's got peak milk written all over it. So if we get cows to peak higher, that sets the lactation curve. So in other words, if cows peak at 120 pounds of milk, there's an opportunity that they will stay at that high level and dry off maybe at 80 pounds of milk during that entire 305 days as far as that goes. Forage quality becomes critical. There are two factors. The first one, of course, is going to be dry matter intake. High quality forage results in higher dry matter intake, and higher dry matter intake will support higher milk components. The second factor is going to be that forages produce acetate and butyrate in the fermentation. These are volatile fatty acids, and those volatile fatty acids are building blocks for the mammary gland. And what the mammary gland says, aha, this is a precursor, and therefore I can build these fatty acids into 16, 18, 14, 12 carbon length fatty acids, and that makes the milk fat as well. Certainly another important fact is going to be, if we're going to look at milk fat, is going to be looking at added fat to the diet. And of course, it was really a hot ticket item, still is of course, is palm oil coming out of Indonesia. And the palm oil, and Michigan State has done some of the classic work on that. And you can increase butterfat test 2 or 3 or 4 tenths of a point as far as that goes as well. So that's a big factor as well. And now the new kid on the block, as we jokingly call it, is going to be high oleic soybeans. Now we have three companies that produce a new kind of hybrid soybean that is high in oleic acid, which is an 18-1. So fatty acids become very important because that affects what the mammary gland does with those fats and what happens in the rumen. And that's a very rumen-friendly fatty acid, and it helps increase the digestibility of all fats in the diet. And so we can buy these soybeans. And what's the good news? The seed doesn't cost any more. It doesn't reduce yield. So therefore, it's almost like we call a win-win situation, especially for our folks here in the Midwest that can raise soybeans on their land. They don't have to buy or purchase soybean products from the marketplace. And it's a homegrown product. And in most cases, we're going to roast those soybeans. By roasting the soybeans, we change the degradability in the rumen. We almost double the amount of protein that escapes degradation by the rumen microbes. And that's really good news because soy protein, as we know in poultry and swine, is a good quality protein high in lysine. And so that's one of our limiting amino acids is lysine. So a lot of that excitement occurs there on the fat side of the equation. We also look at the amino, we look at the protein side, and you're going to smile because you're a poultry person. Basically, our cows are much like chickens. We need amino acids. Cows don't have a crude protein requirement. They have an amino acid requirement. And therefore, can we get the right levels of methionine, lysine, histidine, all those to our dairy cows? And of course, that has, again, forage quality written on it because forage quality stimulates the rumen fermentation, which means I grow those bacteria. And maybe some of our listeners are surprised to hear about two-thirds of the protein that our cow needs, she will actually grow in her rumen, and the amino acid profile of the bacteria are all perfect. Really matches up with the amino acid profile of milk protein and lean tissue there as well in the program. Of course, we can then, if we need some supplemental protein, then we will buy soybeans and or soybean meal, extruded soybeans, things like that, which provide more amino acids. And then, of course, unlike poultry, we have to buy rumen-protected amino acids. And right now, there are rumen-protected amino acids available for both lysine and methionine. And as a result, we can build the ration there. And there's some classic work out of Ohio State that showed where they balanced the amino acids using animal and soy sources along with microbial ones, an extra 8 pounds of milk. Same level of crude protein, but 8 pounds more milk, a tenth of an increase in the milk protein content and basically increased income over feed costs, which is one of the economic measurements, up on extra $1.10 per cow, even though rumen protected amino acids cost about 2 cents per gram. So there are some really neat feed things we can do in terms of boosting the level of components. But remember, there's genetics involved in that one as well, and there's management. So it's like a three-legged stool. You get all three of them right, or your cow will not produce that 7 pounds of components.
You know, it's really interesting when you discuss some of these ingredients, because we also have a lot of interest, like palm oil. You know, that's something that we are also evaluating, you know, looking what is the value in poultry diets. But also, as you're mentioning, we also pay a lot of attention to soybean processing. And when you are processing these soybeans, are you focusing on reducing trypsin inhibitors or more like producing bypass protein?
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, we want to do both of them. We want to get rid of the trypsin inhibitor. In fact, you can feed the soybeans raw. You can't probably do that for swine and poultry, but you can feed them raw. But if you feed more than about 2 pounds, the bacteria can't knock out the trypsin inhibitor enzyme, and that reduces the protein digestibility in the lower tract. So certainly that's one factor. But then, of course, we want to get the rumen undegraded protein. That's what I'm really after as well. So it's a win-win situation on that one as well, because I get both of those factors that occur. Typically, for us roasting, about 50 cents a bushel. And if you look at the value of rumen undegraded protein that you gain, the fat doesn't change. The fat doesn't change, but the protein basically it increases the value of the soybean bean by about $100 a ton. So it's really good. And we can also heat treat the soybean meal. So you can do both the soybeans and the meal and get some of the same benefits. And you can heat treat the canola meal coming out of Canada as well there. So lots of things. But it's interesting because we talk about the soybean, and the fatty acid is important because if you feed polyunsaturated fatty acids, which you'll find in corn and you'll find in conventional soybeans and cottonseed, that really causes a problem in the rumen. One, lowers fiber digestibility. And then second of all, the mammary gland, when these on these PUFAs, conjugated linoleic acids, they are partially hydrogenated in the rumen and forms an isomer. And that isomer will lower butterfat test by, 2 to 4 tenths of a point. In other words, if your herd was at 3.8, you might drop down to 3.4. That's based on some dynamic work done at Cornell University. So this fatty acid thing gets to be a real factor. It can be your friend, and also it can be your enemy. You got to make sure you got the right kinds of fatty acids. And our number that we use, just to give our farmers the guideline, is 500 grams of PUFAs. PUFAs are polyunsaturated fatty acids, and that would be linoleic and linolenic fatty acids in the program. And farmers, if you're feeding corn silage and shell corn, you've got over 400 grams coming from those two sources by themselves.
Okay, and that's why you were discussing at the beginning of the talk that it was important to have varieties of soybeans that are richer in oleic acid instead of linoleic acid, basically.
Exactly. Conventional soybeans would be over 50% unsaturated polyunsaturated fatty acids. The high oil ones will be over 50% oleic fatty acids. By the way, there's some human benefits there as well. It looks a lot like olive oil, to be told the truth. And so there's also some interest in those high oleic soybeans on the human side of it as well. So certainly, I'm not sure what those PUFAs do on poultry or swine, but for dairy, look out. Just got to be careful.
Yeah, with what I have seen is with swine, you just got to be careful towards the end because it's going to affect the quality of the bacon, for example. And that's why, when with swine, we pay a lot of attention with DDGS because there is a lot of, especially like the conventional DDGS, they are going to have a lot of the corn oil, and that can affect the quality of the bacon. And that maybe when you are using like DDGS in rations, you want like the de-oil DDGS because you don't want that oil in the ingredient probably.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In fact, for our listeners, if you're buying distillers grains in Illinois, eyes wide open, because now our processors have discovered that they can take that oil and make biodiesel out of it. And so historically, we used to be 12 or 14% oil. Now we can get it down around 4 or 5%. Now, our beef guys don't like that because that's energy. Trust me, they want that oil for energy. But our dairy guys, boy, they like these new distillers grains because they're much lower in oil as far as that goes. And of course, we see some of that in the soybeans as well, where we ever extruder expelled soybean meal, it'll have 4 or 5% oil in it. So that makes it a much more friendlier product then. But all those add to the PUFA number. So be sure you do your math, have your computer calculate grams per cow per day, and because it will affect rumen dynamics and milk component, in this case, milk fat.
That's very important. That's something I didn't know, but the number that I'm remembering is 500 milligrams or grams per cow.
500 grams. And if you're feeding a heavy corn silage and shell corn diet, you'll have 400 there before you add anything. And that's why a lot of the farmers were buying palmitic oil, because that was a saturated oil and it basically increased butter fat very, very nicely. But let me tell you, when you're paying $1,400 for a ton of palm oil and you can grow soybeans on your farm, boy, it doesn't take you long to figure out where the economics on that's going to go.
Yes. Which, for the Brazilians, probably is really good because they probably have more palm oil available or in Central America. But for the U.S., it will be like a more expensive ingredient, right?
Yes, exactly right. Yeah. Very, very, very expensive. Almost all the dry products, and there are some that have stearic fatty acid. That's a saturated fatty acid as well. There's a number of those that are available on the market in the United States, but all of them are typically in that $1,200 to $1,500 a ton. And so you really got to sharpen your pencil, because if your cows don't make more milk and or butter fat, well, you won't break even. You won't break even.
Anna, you have been talking a lot about like the nutrition side, but what about like, are there any feeding and management practices that can help maximize the genetic potential of a cow to boost these milk components?
Yeah, that's certainly a very fair question. And anything that will negatively affect milk yield or milk components, such as crowding, overcrowding the facility. Some classic work out of the Meinert Institute shows that if you overcrowd the facility, overcrowding meaning that you have less than 24 to 30 inches of feed bunk space for cows to eat, And you, the listeners might say, well, gee, they're out there eating 21 hours a day. Cows don't eat 21 hours a day. They eat basically big meals every time they come from the milking parlor. They'll have 8 or 10 meals a day. So when they go there to the bunk, and then usually if you find one cow at the bunk or two cows at the bunk, you'll find a lot more cows at the bunk as well. So certainly overcrowding would be a factor, both in terms of bunk space and the ability to lie down. Cows have to lie down for over 12 or 13 hours a day. And that's when they basically chew their cud and basically stabilize the rumen from that aspect as well. Certainly another management factor would be lameness. In other words, so you say, what do you mean lameness? Well, if a cow is lame, she will not go to the feed bunk. She doesn't want to lie down aggressively as far as that goes. And she has more stress on her from that aspect as well. We're coming right into the big one right now, and Wilmer, and that's heat stress. Heat stress will normally, in the United States, drop butterfat by about 0.2 of a point. So in other words, if you normally would have a 4-1 butterfat test, and that's pretty much what the Holsteins are averaging right now in the United States, 4-1. And that number has gone up 0.1 of a point every year in the last 5 years. Back 5 years ago, the average butterfat test was 3.7, 3.8. Now we're sitting at 4.1 on Holsteins. Jerseys are also increasing slightly as well. So certainly butterfat. So if you had a 4.1 butterfat test and they're under heat stress, you may see something like 3.8. Or 3.9. And of course, now remember, we're selling pounds of components. And so if you're dropping 2 or 3 tenths of a pound of fat and 1/10 or 2 of protein, now your milk check becomes more smaller from that aspect as well, along with potentially some decrease in milk volume as well. So certainly those are big factors that come into. So anything that affects dry matter intake, cow comfort, availability of stall, anything like that in the management area will have an impact on pounds of components leaving the farm.
And that's what I was thinking when you were talking overcrowding, like heat stress, probably that's related with dry matter intake. The dry matter intake goes down and, you know, like the production of milk components will go naturally down as well.
Yeah, and remember the other amazing thing is not only does the milk goes, the dry matter intake goes down, but at the same time, when cows are under heat stress, their maintenance goes up 10 or 15%. And that's the first bill you're going to pay. You know, that's kind of like you got to pay your rent every day or you could boot it out of the apartment. Well, the cow's maintenance requirement goes up. So maintenance goes up, dry matter goes down, and now guess what has to give? Milk yield and milk components.
Yeah, because they will have to thermoregulate, spend more energy for thermoregulation. And like when you were saying lameness, then they are spending probably like energy for immune function. So all that is going to affect the productivity of the herd. Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because certainly immune function, the running immune system takes a lot of energy. And for dairy cows, that's glucose. And our cows don't run on glucose. We run on volatile fatty acids. So glucose becomes a very critical nutrient because it affects, it's used for lactose synthesis. And lactose is the milk sugar, of course, and that determines milk volume. So it's an interesting story when you look at all these things, add them together.
Yeah. And you know, the other question that I want to ask you, because, you know, like, every time we have more technologies available for, you know, like animal production. So have you seen any promising technologies or modeling tools that help to predict or optimize milk components?
Wow, that's a neat one. Certainly, we can look at additives. I could call that a technology. You might call rumen-protected amino acids also a technology. We looked at, I think people can see that if I feed rumen-protected lysine, obviously I get more in the blood, therefore the cow could produce more milk protein. If I use a sodium bicarb, which is the common buffer, a sodium bicarb or sodium sesquicarbonate, that stabilizes the rumen environment to maintain. We get optimal rumen production of both volatile fatty acids and amino acids out there as well. Certainly, right now, we're seeing farmers now using cameras, becoming very common on dairy farms, not only to determine when a cow is going to have a calf, but looking at feed bunks. So you can see, are we getting feed dropped in the right place in the barn? Believe it or not, much like you and I, you may have a favorite restaurant. Well, cows will have a favorite spot in the feed bunk. And so farmers walk in and say, gee, the bunk is empty over here, but there's feed in another area. And the answer is, well, cows are very territorial. So that's where they want to eat their feed. So if you have a picture of that, you might tell your feeder, we'll drop in twice as much feed in that portion of the barn. And so our listeners might say, well, why would that be important? Because it might be less heat stress there, or less competition, or closer from the milking parlor. So cows may want to eat, stop there first to eat and go with that as well. Certainly, we're going to be looking at, there's some technology now to weigh cows. And so we can now monitor, if we weigh these cows as they come through the milking parlor, we'll know if they're losing weight or gaining weight. And these cameras can also are going to be trained to do body condition scoring. So we can see if cows are losing body weight, because that affects fertility. It also affects milk yield and also metabolic disorders such as ketosis. So those kinds of technology are coming. And then, of course, the artificial intelligence is going to be a big factor, because now farmers are getting inundated with data, especially when we start seeing herds with 1,000 cows. Because remember, we're kind of monitoring individual cows, but she's out there with 999 others of her herd mates out there as well. And so the AI can capture milk production in the milking parlor every day. It can capture heat, temperature of the cow. And so it also can monitor rumination. We can actually measure how many minutes a cow spends eating and chewing her cud. And that magic number is 550 to 600 minutes a day. And so basically, a farmer could have the AI ask you, okay, which one of these 1,000 cows, which one of the 15 of them should I have someone look at? Is something is going on? Is she lame? Is she in heat? Is she sick? She's got a metabolic, what's the problem? And so this AI thing is going to come. Right now, the problem we have is a lot of the, for example, one system doesn't talk to the other systems. And so now I've got four different sources of information coming in, and the farmer is supposed to sit down and digest all four of them. And oh, by the way, he's got 1,000 cows to manage every day as well. So that's going to be something in the future as well, the ability to collect all this data. And with robotic milkers now, we can get milk production, we can get conductivity scores, we can get the timing of when cows go into these stalls, just a massive amount of good information.
Yeah, but like you're saying, you know, like all these technologies, I think the industry right now is collecting a lot of information. And in the future, we should be able to integrate all those, you know, the information generated here with the generation generated here and how they interact together. So, yeah, I think the, you know, like the whole animal industry is moving like in the right direction. And at the end, what we want is to produce more efficiently, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, you mentioned it right now. Here's one for your listeners. We come up with a number and it says, if you take the dry matter a cow eats, let's say she eats 50 pounds of dry matter, if you 10% of that should end up in milk solids. So in other words, 50 pounds of dry matter, that would be 5 pounds of milk solids, fat and protein. Not a very fancy number. If she's eating 60 pounds of dry matter and you multiply by 10%, now you got 6 pounds. But good herds will be at 13%. So now we have a feed efficiency that we can look at based on milk components. And if you get closer, you can get to 12 or 13% of the dry matter as milk solids, you're going to be in the right spot. Because obviously, if I'm only getting 10%, now I'm not getting optimizing the nutrients that are in that dry matter for those cows. And maybe that's because the ration is not balanced or there's some other environmental factors going on. But the question is, why? What's going on?
Yeah. And, you know, like I know that we are getting to the end of the episode, but like, you know, like I work as an extension specialist here in Auburn, and we also have like extension specialists that listen to this podcast. So I would like to ask you, what are, in your opinion, the most effective ways to bridge the research that is generated, at the university with the farm application of that knowledge?
Yeah, that's a very important question for basically consultants or veterinarians or extension people. And that is, number one, keep up with the information. You got to read your journals. You have to read the research, get to the various regional meetings. We have several that are just excellent meetings that do a nice job of summarizing that information. So number one, you've got to be current. You got to be at the cutting edge. So you should know all, if you're a dairy nutritionist and don't know about Ohio Lake soybeans, then you better catch up pretty quickly as far as that goes. I think then the second one is, how do you package it? When I first came into Extension, we would at Minnesota, I would do 120 meetings a year, 120 meetings a year in Minnesota. And so we don't do that anymore. Basically, farmers are busy. They've got other things going on. So I think we're going to be looking at, first, if you've got good information, you present it at a good format. People like to hear your information. And then I think the podcast, which you're doing here today, the webinars are going to be increasingly important. And not only is Extension making those, but also companies are doing it as well. So if you're a good Extension person, don't be afraid to team up with maybe a feed mill or a feed company or a pharmaceutical company and work with them, because they do reach outreach and have tremendous tools as well. So I think that's kind of the key I would look at is, number one, be current. Number two, great delivery system. And finally, looking at some of the newer technologies of podcasting and using the webinars to distribute it as well. And online classes. Our Brazil one is a good example. You can anytime, any day, you can go down and you can study. And if you finish it, you get a certificate and you can get it done in 3 months or 3 years. Whenever you get it done, you take the quizzes and you get it.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that last point, because, you know, when I came to the U.S., I came to work in a feed mill in North Carolina, and I was just looking the daily operation of a feed mill. But then 6 months later, I enrolled a class in North Carolina State University that was related to feed milling, and it was very easy to connect what I was looking in the feed mill with the concepts in the class. And that's, once that you put all that together, it just helps to improve the efficiency of any operation. So I'm glad that you are bringing that too. But also, you know, like in this podcast, we also have students that likes to listen to this podcast. So what kind of advice would you give, like, you know, like to either undergrad students or grad students that might be interested in dairy nutrition or dairy science?
Well, I think any way they can get experience. Growing up on a Wisconsin dairy farm is something I did not learn at the University of Wisconsin. That's something my dad basically exposed me to as far as that goes. So any way you can get hands-on experience, if you don't have that, get that chance. For example, we'll take our graduate students with us when we went on farm visits and let them collect feed samples, do manure scoring, body condition scoring, so they would learn what that is as well. And then they have to have a real background would be good, good information, good training. So if you're going to work in a feed mill, have some training in feed mill expertise. If you're work dairy cattle, have some training. And that's where these certificates come into play, because some of these people will get a salary increase, or the company will pay for that class out there as well. And then when you're working with producers, you got to like people and you got to like cows. Now, maybe you work with poultry, you got to like chickens. I'm not a big chicken person, but that's okay. But <Yeah. laughs> you got to like the industry, and you got to like the people. And the neat thing about the dairy industry is I'm sure that's true in most livestock enterprises, the people are real good people, good, hardworking, honest people, and very receptive to ideas. And if you get a good idea, you'll have them as a supporter for you in your programs.
That's very important. And, you know, like, there is something that I sometimes even advise the companies. It's like, if you have employees that get a certificate, you know, a lot of the employees are doing it in the free time. So you should give them something back to that employee for investing that time, because at the end, that education is helping the company to be more profitable in the future.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's a great point. Good point.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Michael. That concludes another episode of the Feed Science Podcast Show, presented by Wisenerics. Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to subscribe to stay updated on future episodes. And if you enjoy today's episode, please leave us a comment. Again, Dr. Michael, thank you so much. And I hope you and everyone listening have a blessed day.
Thank you very much. You have a good day. Bye-bye.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.